get you get analysis of the education.
Well, that's nice.
But the way they did the exam, her seven, most people pass that one for the percentage of her master's or fellowship, which is close to that. So then they get that fifth and around. So you have a big class.
Yeah.
So you get like 100 in the November.
Which is nice.
But you have the off cycle.
Yeah, I got you.
To get yours at this point. So basically,
well, they, how many would it be if it was on second?
Like, that's a 100
round. Yeah.
You know, depending on how large the class is.
Dennis,
this
morning.
Hi.
And it was like there was not a CEO. It was an enterprise risk management session. Whatever they call it, plenary general session. Not a concurrent session, a regular session.
General
session.
There's only one.
Yeah, because it was packed. Okay, so none of my cameras.
Oh, why not?
Oh, yeah.
So let me get it back for you.
Sorry, we're in good hands.
Oh, so you think we're good. I was estimating 2 more minutes.
Well, it looks like most people have found the rooms now that the featured speaker's done, so why don't we get started? Good afternoon and welcome to the session on Should There Be a National Catastrophe Pool? My name's David Chernick. I'm currently employed with Milliman as a consulting actuary. I've had some extensive expertise in property insurance, including all sorts of rate-making applications, including pricing of the hurricane and earthquake peril, and also extensive experience in catastrophe management. I had the opportunity to chair the Florida Windstorm Underwriting Association Actuarial Committee back in the 90s, you know, after Andrew and before the latest series of hurricanes, and was heavily involved in the implementation of a new and unique class plan that attempted to recognize some of the mitigation procedures you could do to buildings to actually reduce the potential damage from hurricanes. I will be the moderator of this panel, and my job's pretty simple. I've just got to keep these two lawyers on a time schedule. Now, I think we're going to be a little off because the speaker went about 10 minutes over, so we'll adjust accordingly, but didn't really want to cut the time for questions short at the end. So what we're going to do is something a little bit different. We've kind of structured a debate type format for this session. Each one of the speakers will give a primary presentation, and then they'll each get about 10 minutes in the second round to rebut each other's. So I would ask during those primary presentations, let's hold the questions, but when we get into that rebuttal session, we would like to encourage the audience to help each one in their rebuttal questioning of the other. So we'll kind of play that by ear and see how it goes, but feel free to raise your hand if you want to interject a thought during the rebuttal time. And then we're also going to spend or try to save about 15 minutes at the end so you guys can actually directly ask each one of the panelists questions. So it's my pleasure to introduce our two panelists. First, from Allstate Insurance Corporation, is Ed Collins, who is a managing counsel for Allstate Corporation. He has held various positions within Allstate's law and regulation department, covering virtually the entire range of legal and public policy issues an insurance company faces. At Allstate, Ed has managed processes to set up companies, to withdraw companies, and to operate them profitably in the nation's most challenging markets. That must be New Jersey. Huh? Ed has managed complex litigation, including numerous rate cases from the filing stage through the administrative hearing and appellate processes in the courts. Throughout his career, Ed has led all states, legislative and regulatory affairs in numerous different states. Ed helped create and implement Allstate's regional council organization and now leads this team in managing Allstate's legislative and regulatory affairs on a countrywide basis. Ed is also currently serving as National Director of ProtectingAmerica.org, a coalition, of first responders, emergency management professionals, building code experts, business leaders, and others. Ed will be doing the pro position on should there be a national catastrophe pool. Our other panelist is Mary Seidel. Mary is Vice President and Director of Federal Affairs for the Reinsurance Association of America, the RAA. It was incorporated in 1969. The RAA is a nonprofit trade association composed of member companies, which are principally engaged in the business of assuming property and casualty reinsurance. As Vice President and Director of Federal Affairs, Mary is the chief lobbyist representing RAA member companies before the U.S. Congress and the administration on those issues affecting the reinsurance industry, including such things as asbestosis, litigation reform, class action reform, terrorist insurance, natural disaster financing, and international and corporate tax issues. Prior to joining the RAA, Mary worked on the financial institutions practice team at another prominent lobbying firm. At that firm, she represented small and large financial institutions involving numerous aspects of banking and security legislation before Congress. So at this point, we'd like to start the primary presentations, and Ed Collins will start. Ed.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon. I find this very powerful slide presentation that I'm going to show you. Okay. So the question is it time to enact reform that would include a national backstop? And the answer is emphatically yes. Now is the time, and I want to give you a couple of perspectives. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you two perspectives. I'm going to give you the perspective of the insurance company and the investor, and give you the perspective of the consumer. And I'm going to spend most of my time on the perspective of the consumer, because that's what I have been doing for the past year with James Lee Witt, former FEMA director, and Admiral James Loy, who was head of the Coast Guard for 40 years, ended his career as Commandant of the Coast Guard, and then was Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. They are co-chairmen of ProtectingAmerica.org, and we are pursuing a campaign across this country to better prepare and protect America from catastrophe. So I'm going to talk to you about that and put it in the context of the question posed today. Okay? So first, I want to give you the perspective of the insurance company and the investor. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we want to reserve time, as we said. But you know, look at some of these points. We've had unprecedented losses, and the forecast is very ominous indeed. Remarkable performance should be noted by our claims professionals. I mean, we should be very proud of the industry in which we are part of, and the unbelievable work that claims professionals did in the face of the Gulf storms last year. Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, just unbelievable under extraordinary circumstances, and of course the work is continuing. The companies and the investors are certainly concerned about litigation, and you've heard and read, I'm sure, quite a bit about that, and the only point I'm going to make on it is that it certainly creates uncertainty, and that uncertainty is bad for the market. Potential insolvencies are coming, folks. The future is not as certain as some might hope. And I want to challenge my colleague, Mary, to sort of focus on this, that
It certainly is my understanding of the facts that private reinsurance capacity is limited. There's no question that the current availability is strained, and the affordability that we're seeing right now presents serious challenge. This availability and affordability issue in the private reinsurance market leaves something to be desired at the moment. So I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that America is not as prepared to deal with major natural catastrophes as it should be, and that's from the insurance company and investor perspective, and the status quo is unacceptable. So I want to shift over to the consumer perspective, okay? And we've talked to consumers across the country, and let me tell you what this issue is really all about. This is about saving lives and protecting what people spend their whole lives building. This is not an insurance issue. Insurance is part of the solution, to be sure. This is a national economic issue. This is a homeland security issue. It's a consumer protection issue. It's a lot more than insurance. Again, insurance is part of the solution. But for the consumer, this is about saving lives and protecting what they spend their whole lives building. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the problem and then get to the solution from the consumer point of view. This is really what the homeowner faces, and I won't go through all of it, but this is a good graphic depiction of the challenge that the faces the homeowner. And, you know, the reality is that the stakes are higher than they've ever been, and they're higher than they've ever been just from a simple basic financial security point of view, because Americans are putting so much more of their entire net worth and their future financial security into their homes. And so there's more at stake. And here's what's happening in our country. We have a protection gap that is growing. I'm going to give you a little bit on this graphic. The risk is rising for the consumer, and protection is declining. This is a problem. This we have to address. This is why it's time now to take action for reform. The risk is rising really for three reasons. The risk is rising because of demographics, because of property values, and because of the forecast. Okay, so here's population, just a quick snapshot. We have in our country an infatuation with weather, warm weather, and water. And the population has moved closer to the coastline, and when you add it up, more than half of our country now is living in reasonably close proximity to the coasts and are living on fault lines. And so the demographic change is something that is contributing to the risk increasing. Home values are going through the roof, excuse the pun. And they're rising the quickest, as you see, in the places that are most exposed. So that's increasing the risk. And of course, the weather. And not just what we've seen in the past couple of years, we ain't seen nothing yet. We need to challenge our imaginations because, you know, we continue to think that, well, that's about as bad as it can get. Well, we know it's not as bad as it can get, what we've seen. And if you study what the modelers are talking about, you know that the trend line we're looking at here, and I know I'm going to go through all the science, but when it comes to hurricane, the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation, the cyclical nature of hurricane activity, we're in an active period, more frequent, more ferocious hurricanes, not much scientific doubt about that. The Atlantic conveyor belt is in high gear. And we also know that there's going to be another major earthquake, quakes, plural. We don't know when, but it's going to happen. So risk is on the rise. And so, you know, here's just a graphic that you've seen some of these numbers before about, you know, how many big ones have happened recently. I was participated in a program, and, you know, the modelers talk about just another San Francisco quake. I was at the Centennial Conference April 18th. It was around the 18th, the week of the 18th. The 18th was the actual anniversary. And Estimates vary, but one estimate is that a repeat of the 1906 quake in San Francisco could be $400 billion in economic damage. And the New Madrid fault is going to someday rip open the ground. And modelers talk about a $200 to $300 billion event there. And as I mentioned, the Atlantic conveyor belt is in high gear. And I don't think anyone can deny that. You know, I just pull a couple of examples. A direct hit on Miami, some estimate $120 billion. New York, I put $100 billion plus. A 1938 Long Island Express repeat, and a lot of people still kind of don't think earthquakes hit New York. Well, they do. They have, and they're going to again. If you move that 1938 storm just a little bit to the left, to the west, you're talking about well over $100 billion. And there's all kinds of different scenarios that put Manhattan basically underwater. And that's not a pretty scenario. But easily in excess of $100 billion. And here's a key point. Is, you know, we used to be in a paradigm where we used to measure and assess based on, you know, one big event a year. Well, we know from the 2004 and the 2005 that multiple major events are inevitable. We've had them recently and we're going to have them again. We hope it's a long time into the future, but we got to be prepared. So that's a little bit on the risk going up. I'm going to race through a couple of points on why protection is going down and why the gap is increasing. Well, if you have the inability to predict and you're getting poor returns, that's going to end up in capital moving away from a particular investment, and that's certainly what's happening in the primary homeowners insurance market. That's to be distinguished from the reinsurance market, which is an entirely different kind of business model and investment. Certainly different returns. You guys know the reasons why the market currently is strained, is in becoming even more so. I won't go through all of that. Here's some other, you know, facts that just, this is part of the reality and why that protection gap is increasing. You know, the return, I was struck by this. I had the assumption that when you look back over a longer period of time, that the rate of return for homeowners insurers is pretty good, you know, because why would companies be in the business if it's not? Well, it's not. It's a god-awful return. I mean, forget about 04, 05. You go back a long period of time, it's a terrible return. So the underlying motivation to be in this line of business, you know, is, I think some people are starting to wonder about that. But anyway, the point is the protection gap is growing, that graphic that I showed you, and it's not a surprise why it is. So I wanted to give you a little bit of that. And here's what I want to spend a few minutes focusing on, because this is good news, okay? This is good news, that there is a better way. There's a better way to prepare and protect America from catastrophe. I'm not going to talk about terrorism because there's a lot of focus on preventing terrorism. What I'm going to focus a little bit on is earthquake and hurricane, tsunami, other perils, but natural catastrophe. And it's very exciting to me that there is a better way, a comprehensive integrated solution that will strengthen the public-private partnership. And again, we went out, we talked to consumers across the country, we talked to experts in various fields. James Lee Witt, Admiral Loy, led the way, and we put together what we believe, protectingamerica.org, working to better prepare and protect America, five components. I'm going to give you an outline of the five key components. First, we need to do a better job providing financial protection to consumers. And that includes having an integrated state and national financial backstop that provides more protection at lower cost. But it's more than that. It's also, we have to do a better job with prevention and mitigation. And that's better building codes, enforcement of building codes, land use policies, retrofits, and more. I could spend an hour talking to you about that. Third, we need to do a better job preparing for catastrophe. And part of that is strengthening first responders. We need to strengthen first responders in our country. And after the event, we need to now figure out better ways. You know, we were out talking to people about this before Katrina. Katrina has validated all of this. We know we can do a better job with the relief, recovery, and rebuilding process. Again, not to go into a lot of details, but there's a lot there. Fourth, we need to do a better job educating consumers. We need to educate consumers and the public, and you know there's a big degree of personal responsibility in that. We need to do a better job educating consumers about the personal responsibility they have. There are ways to better prepare themselves. There's a protection available. You know, I'm struck by the unbelievable number, 14%. That's the number of consumers in California that purchase available earthquake coverage. And we need to do something about that. Part of it lies in consumer education. And on the back end, when it comes to consumer education, you can give them better protection. I can tell you stories about the people who are preyed upon after disasters, the predators that go into areas, and you know, like the senior citizen who turns his or her insurance check over to a guy to come back and fix the roof, and they never come back. We need to pay more attention to that, and we are. And fifth, as part of a comprehensive solution, what we need to do is build right into the law, right into our process in our country. And again, this is integrated at the local, state, and national level, is a rigorous process of continuous improvement. And what we offer is to have a team of experts, again, local, state, national, public, private sector, and a team of experts after every major event. They go to the scene, they survey the situation, they make recommendations for improvement, and we continuously learn from that, and we continue to improve the way that we're dealing with it. You know, today, we have a react and respond system in our country. I use the metaphor, we have two systems, basically, a helicopter plan, and that helicopter plan, basically, you have a catastrophe, somebody important, it's typically a governor, gets up into the helicopter, surveys the situation, and there's this lever, and they hit the lever, push the lever, and the door opens, and money comes flowing out, okay? And then that's one plan. And then the other plan is when it's an even bigger one. Katrina was an example. That's the Air Force One plan, okay? So Air Force One gets up, and there's this really big lever, and they push that lever, and bigger door opens and billions come out. That's America's system today. It's react and respond. We have to shift from that. This last point will help us there. We have to shift from that react and respond. Instead of reacting and responding, we've got to start preparing and protecting. The area of primary disagreement between those who are advancing reform and those who are defending the status quo really comes down to whether or not we need to take action before crisis, or if we should just wait till the next big event and then try and figure it out. We think it's more responsible to act before the next crisis, to take action. Part of that is providing, I was telling you, the first point of the reform is to have better financial protection for consumers, to have integrated state and national financial backstop. And this would be, despite what you've heard some say, and you may hear today, pre-funded, it's a very good idea, we think, actuarially sound, okay? No subsidy, okay? Those who live on the beach need to pay for living on the beach. But guess what? They need to do that in a way that reduces subsidy. Folks, there's subsidy today. A lot of people want you to believe that if you create a financial backstop system that it depends on subsidy. The opposite is true. Today, we're relying on subsidy. Today, when companies go flat on their back, when they go bankrupt, and that's what's going to happen when we have another major, major event or series of events, that's our system today. They go flat on their back. Guess what? You got to go to the guarantee fund. Well, the guarantee fund, there might not be enough companies left, but let's assume that there are. Well, guess how they fund the guarantee fund? It's policyholder subsidy. So let's pre-fund it. Actuarially sound, that's more responsible. And of course, we need to do something to deal with the taxpayer subsidy that's in the issue, and our proposal will do that. Now, the backstop model primarily will benefit consumers and taxpayers for these reasons. I'm going to run down real quick on these. more protection, more affordable, and it finances and facilitates the other components of the solution. This is the beauty of the model. This is why it's not just a cat fund, it's more than a cat fund. More protection. It's more protection because it increases capacity. None of these other ideas increase capacity. I've heard about how, you know, $20 billion of new private reinsurance capitals come into the market. Well, that's a fraction of what was sucked out of the market the past couple of years. And there's a limit. What is it, $60 billion, $100 billion of reinsurance capital in the world? What about those modeled numbers I showed you? And those aren't the worst case scenarios. So we need to be conscious of the fact that we need to increase capacity. And the proposal that I'm offering provides maximum capacity. At the state and national level, at that national backstop, you have maximum possible capacity. And you do it in a way that provides more stability and certainty. You know, if the situation is what it is right now, we don't know what the next year brings. We don't know what's going to happen to the private reinsurance market the year after next. We don't know what's going to happen to their investors and what they're going to do with their capacity, but we do know if you have an integrated state and national backstop, so you're going to have more stability, more certainty. So that's more protection, and of course it's at the lowest possible cost too. You know, the private reinsurance market on its own, it's 3 to 4 times more expensive for the consumer than having that be part of, not replacing, part of the proposal that we're talking about. And it's more affordable, and you guys know this, it's more affordable because it operates on a nonprofit basis and it's tax exempt. That's why the 3 to 4 times cost differential. But here's a really important point. It's not just, like I said, more protection at lower cost, and that's really a big thing. We've talked to consumers and that's big. But the integrated state and national backstop will finance and facilitate the other components of the solution. You can take a small percentage of the investment income, and that can help do things like the consumer education, like the better prevention and the mitigation to strengthen first responders. So it ties it all together, and that's why it makes sense. So it is the financial protection and these other components of the solution. And I challenge you, ladies and gentlemen, and I challenge my colleague, Mary, to finally stand up and recognize that it's a matter of when and where, it's not if, and it's time for action. And you know, thank goodness there are leaders that are working in this country to advance the solution. It's happening at the national level, it's happening at the state level, it's happening at the NEIC level. What I encourage you to do is to go to the website, www.protectingamerica.org. I've got some brochures for some people. If you want to stay around afterwards, I can talk to you a little bit more. But let me say this. Mary, the status quo is unacceptable, and reform is inevitable, and I hope that the RAA will join with us soon. So I'll turn it over to Mary.
Well, I'm glad he ended on a positive note. And I will make sure to address the private reinsurance aspect. Maybe when I'm finished, you can talk about the $1.75 billion worth of private reinsurance Allstate was able to secure for 2006. What I'm going to do, since a lot of his subject matter is focused, really his whole solution really is aimed at, despite many of the things we agree on in terms of mitigation and some of the education campaigns Allstate's undertaken, the reality is the gist of their proposal is to create a federal reinsurance program. So I'm going to speak today from the RAA's perspective about that. And at first, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the RAA. I know many of you are probably familiar with us, but I think it's important because the RAA represents U.S. reinsurers. But many of ours are foreign-owned, so we have a good feel of the marketplace. You know, Cologne Re, Munich Re, Swiss Re. We have many Bermuda startups that are affiliate members of ours. And we feel like we have a really good pulse of the marketplace, so we can kind of answer some of these questions. Additionally, we have a reinsurance brokers that are members, and they obviously have their clients that they care about, the direct companies, as well as reinsurers. So we get a chance to talk to them about the marketplace as well. Just generally, the RIA does believe that a natural catastrophe is insurable in the free market, and I think it's important to think about the free market. Unlike terrorism, where we're not actively writing terrorism reinsurance, we are in the natural disaster area. The second point about we think that the federal government's role should be limited to the large event, quite frankly, the proposals we see out there that would create a federal role, we wouldn't even want that kind of role in a $100 billion event because we think that the program is flawed. But I think that it's important to talk about, rather than this gloom situation, there is actually a pretty good reinsurance story to talk about over the last 10 years, and we feel generally, but over the last 10 years, as it says, 8 of the most expensive disasters occurred in the last 4 years. In 2004, you can't forget, we thought that was a huge year. There was $30 billion of insured losses, and there was no insurer solvencies, and there was no reinsurance solvencies. And for 2005, there was limited impact on capacity. I will say Florida is unique, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a federal program for one state. And the pricing was not out of range. Then came 2005. And as the slide suggests, it was the costliest year in the history of natural disasters, $80 billion. And the reinsurance industry absorbed actually 60% of the losses. And I think it's important to look at how they absorbed them. The reinsurance industry, let me get my slide here. Many of Allstate's proposals really aimed at creating a state cat fund and having all the risk in the state cat fund and then have the federal government bail it out. But with the 60% of reinsurance losses in 2000, the reinsurers actually picked up in 2006, we spread risk. U.S. reinsurers picked up 9% of it. Bermuda reinsurers about 27%. European reinsurers, excluding Lloyd's, about 15%. Lloyd's had 8%, and the rest was about 1%. So reinsurance was the risk was spread when it came to picking up these losses. Fortunately, despite the fact that we actually were... You know, people thought, oh my God, what's going to happen to the reinsurance industry? There were no insolvencies. We believe that 2005 was an earnings event rather than a capital event. And we think that the reinsurance industry played a major role in allowing that to be the case. Despite what some might say, reinsurance also isn't the best business to be in. Last year, our combined ratio was 126. And the U.S. reinsurance industry lost $1.75 billion. So we understand reinsurance is expensive, but fortunately for us, we get to charge the appropriate price for the risk. The direct companies don't. I mentioned the outlook for 2006 because Allstate came up with their proposal. They drug it out of the closet. I worked on it 8 years ago, and it didn't have any support back then. But because of the excitement surrounding Katrina and Wilma and Rita, they brought it back to the forefront again. And so we believe the outlook for 2006 is pretty good. And again, we do think that Florida is unique. But we see new capital coming in. We also see that there wasn't tremendous increase in pricing. I will say that there's going to be, in the spring renewals, we believe there'll be some reduced capacity in Florida. But overall, it's not this horrific situation that some have painted. So generally, as I said, we believe that there's no major need for a federal reinsurance program, and we agree with Allstate that we think that the federal government's role really, or state, should be aimed at mitigation, development of land use policies, and providing coverage options, and price deregulation at the state level, which would allow for insurers, maybe Allstate would want to write more if they could get the price, and yes, unfortunately, it will be expensive for consumers, but if they choose to live somewhere, that's the price you have to pay. Just generally, real quick, I don't need to go through all these slides, but I think our problem is because Allstate's proposal is so aimed at state cat funds, we're kind of scratching our heads thinking, what's the success story? The state cat funds, we believe, are not working that well. I mean, in Florida, you have a $1.7 billion deficit, and the insurance availability is still difficult, as well as the price for insurance. In the California Earthquake Authority, there's $8 billion in capacity, but the market share for eligible homes is 13%. prior to the CEA, there was 37% availability. So we're not sure what the success story is to build a federal program around these state CAT funds. We think that last case resort, maybe a state CAT fund would be appropriate, but it has to have adequate pricing, sound underwriting, mitigation, and voluntary participation. And that's not what we see in the Allstate proposal. And these are just some of our concerns with the state CAT funds that we have. And we think it's interesting that I'm not the state lobbyist, but we do have state lobbyists that work in Louisiana and Texas and New York and New Jersey and all the states that have considered state CAT funds, and they've overwhelmingly been rejected. Let's see, I don't want to miss anything on that point. But Ed talked about his proposal, but I don't think he got very specific about what this federal reinsurance program actually does. But we have some serious concerns with it. I'm not sure if you know this, but the legislation provides for a 1-in-50-year event trigger. Well, when we worked on this 8 years ago, the trigger level for federal government involvement was 1-in-100 initially, or $2 billion event. Well, fortunately, this program was not put in place because the federal government would have picked up most of the losses in 2004 and 2005. We believe that, you know, 1-in-50-year event trigger levels for a federal reinsurance program is just absurd and absolutely ridiculous. It completely interferes with the private reinsurance market. During the debate in Congress 8 years ago, those trigger levels were raised to a 1-in-1-250-year event or $5 billion event. And we actually thought they should be higher than that, but there was a recognition in Congress that 1-in-100 or $2 billion was too low. And Congress definitely understood that the solution they're proposing completely interferes with the private reinsurance market. Another thing that's interesting is that he talks about price and that reinsurance is going to be, you know, it's going to be so much cheaper for the consumer because private reinsurance is 3 to 4 times expensive. Well, it is expensive. It's an expensive product because we get to write it and we look at the risk and we charge what's appropriate for the risk. And if you have this federal reinsurance program, we believe that the reinsurance will be underpriced. There's no risk load associated with it. So clearly, absolutely, it's going to be cheaper. But should the federal government get involved in selling gasoline because we're all concerned about gasoline prices? I don't think that's a good road to go down. Another thing that's interesting about the bill that Allstate had introduced is that in previous versions of the legislation, the federal program, there was many, and it was basically built on RIA's lobbying and other people's as well, and also congressional pressures. There's a lot of cannot compete with the private sector language. There's always an argument about what is the capacity of the private sector. Well, in previous versions of this legislation, at least there was an acknowledgement that, okay, we can't compete with the private sector, or we'll test the private sector. And if the private sector, reinsurance sector, cannot provide capacity, then the federal government will step in. But the new bill that Allstate had introduced strips all the private sector protection language. Also, in previous versions of the bill, it wasn't just a sale of reinsurance to state CAT funds. It was a sale of reinsurance auctions. So the federal government would auction off reinsurance contracts, and the direct company could buy one. Reinsurance companies could buy them. And then there was also language we were able to secure that said, first, though, let's have Treasury put out a rulemaking process, and we'll put out a price, or the federal government will put out a contract, and we'll test the private reinsurance market and see if the private reinsurance market wants to match the federal contract. And if they do, then the federal government won't sell the reinsurance and the private sector can. And again, this was all because Congress recognized that maybe there's an appropriate role, but they wanted to test the role before they just started off with the 1-in-50-year event trigger. Also, I just want to add that there's a lot of doom and gloom scenarios about $400 billion and that this is going to be so costly. Allstate's proposal really only addresses homeowners insurance. And 65% of the Katrina, Rita, and Wilma's losses last year were commercial, does not have any commercial coverage in there. And also, infrastructure. As you know, Allstate has suggested that, well, the federal government's paying all this money anyway. Well, they're paying money not so people can build back their homes. In some instances, they are, but a lot of the money that they're paying out is for infrastructure, to build bridges, to get towns up and running. And this solution to the whole grand problem doesn't even address infrastructure. So we can't support it for those kind of key reasons. And then finally, I think there needs to be a little bit of a reality check as we consider the Allstate's federal reinsurance program, there's absolutely, positively no appetite in Capitol Hill or the administration to create a federal reinsurance program, period. I work very hard on the terrorism reinsurance legislation, and I will tell you, I can't tell you how many times I have to argue to the administration and Republicans in the Congress that there is not a private or not a good private reinsurance for terrorism. There's not a good terrorism reinsurance market. The federal program is not infringing on us. They think the federal terrorism reinsurance program is infringing on us, and even though we only are providing about $4 to $6 billion of capacity, and they are very reluctant to even renew TRIA when it expires. And you turn that into natural disasters where there is a vibrant reinsurance market, and the congressional people I've talked to say there's no appetite. In fact, they haven't even held a hearing on it yet, which we were surprised because we thought, well, of course we'll expect to have a hearing on insurance availability and the impact on reinsurance markets, and there hasn't been one yet. We do expect probably one in the spring because hurricane season's starting up, but it's just a non-starter period, and particularly if you're going to start with one in 50-year event triggers. If you look at TRIA, the terrorism reinsurance law, the private market has to absorb significant losses before the federal reinsurance kicks in. I'd also say that there's very limited insurance industry support. I'm not just talking from the reinsurance side. I have a pretty decent pulse of the appetite because I am a lobbyist in Washington and I talk to other insurance lobbyists. But for a couple companies, the gist of the commercial and homeowners insurance market is opposed to creating a federal program in this area. I will say I'm not suggesting that there isn't issues that certainly the big one could cause problems, but the solution to just create say that the whole problem is reinsurance and that the federal government's just got to step in at very low levels and then the federal government's got to beef up these state cat funds, we don't believe that's going to result in a positive impact, and we believe that it's going to significantly interfere with the reinsurance market. And then, like I said, finally, this one slide, and I mean it. You have to be careful what you ask for, because Allstate, if they want this particular bill, the political process is going to change it, and they're going to probably say, "Well, if we're going to provide cheap reinsurance, then you have to offer. The only way you're going to get this program is mandatory offer. You have to offer homeowners insurance to all takers." And I know that during the debate in 1998, Allstate adamantly opposed an all takers amendment, and I think that's really what Congress will expect if they're going to be doling out taxpayer dollars for companies to buy cheap reinsurance.
Okay, well. Well, thanks, Ed and Mary. Now we're going to move to our rebuttal round. So Ed will be back up to offer a few comments on what Mary has just said. And again, I want to encourage anybody who wants to ask questions at this point, raise your hand and we'll try and acknowledge you as soon as we can.
Maybe we'll just do it.
Yeah, you can do it here if you want.
So I can, just kidding.
That's a good idea. Mary makes a great case. There's no question about that. She's a very good advocate working in our nation's capital. And I've heard Mary today and some of her colleagues in other forums basically articulate, I'll play it back for you. I've heard opponents to this plan basically say, well, don't do that because you can't trust government, okay? You can't have a comprehensive integrated reform because you can't trust government. Well, let's face reality, folks. The government is and must be involved in preparing and protecting Americans from catastrophe. There's no question. What we're recommending is to have a smarter role for government. Again, instead of that react and respond approach, we're talking about a more thoughtful approach, a smarter role for government, because government's involved today and always will be. So that's one line of thought. Another line of thought is, this whole notion of, and some of it's clever and it's intimated and not entirely stated, that it all depends on subsidy. And like to point to Florida and California that things aren't working well there. Well, let me tell you something, folks. Again, the opposite is true when it comes to subsidy. And let me give you a couple of points on Florida and California. Florida, let's look at what happened after Hurricane Andrew, right? After Hurricane Andrew, the entire market collapsed. Is that good for our industry or for consumers? Of course not. Fast forward to 2004, four major hurricanes strike Florida. The market did okay. The consumer did okay. Why? Because of the CAT fund. The only thing that's right now working well in the state of Florida, because it has some problems, Citizens is the chief among them, is the CAT fund. I quote Governor Bush, thank God for the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. Florida CAT fund is a great model, and it's working well. California, let's go over to California. Again, 1994, Northridge earthquake, the entire market collapsed. Had it not been for the creation of the California Earthquake Authority, people wouldn't have been able to buy homes. They wouldn't have been able to get insurance. So Florida and California are great models for the consumer. And they can work well for the private reinsurance market too. What we have to do is work together, find common ground. So that's another kind of line of thought. And then the third version, we heard a version of that again today. This is the denial, living in denial. It's a plan that says, you know what, everything's fine. Just raise rates and hope for the best. Can't afford that anymore. The stakes are too high. Delay, linger, wait isn't the right approach. So we're encouraging people, and again, we're working with not just insurance people, we're working with others to do the right thing, and it's to be prepared. Based on these scenarios, it's not gloom and doom and gloom. We're trying to paint a picture of reality and challenge people to take responsible action before the crisis. So that line of thought that is in denial, plan that says everything's fine, just raise rates and hope for the best, we think is irresponsible. We think it's more responsible to act before the crisis.
Well, I would just... repeat myself that to address some of the points he just rebutted with. I think it's great that Allstate is leading the charge for Protect America, but again, I think it's a little misleading because it's maybe protecting America on one, if it even works, on one aspect, that's homeowners insurance availability. It's not protecting America for infrastructure, and it's not protecting small businesses that will go under if a hurricane hits. It's just, it does nothing for them. So I'm kind of dumbfounded by the thought that it's protecting America when it's really just aimed at homeowners insurance availability. And in terms of the CAT funds, again, I agree. I think that Florida's unique, and certainly I think it's an issue there that I understand there's limited, there's not as much private reinsurance there, but this CAT fund idea concerns us. I mean, it sounds like, you know, the governor thinks it's a great deal, but I don't know how great the people are going to feel when they issue the bonds and people are going to have to pay taxpayer assessments. And it's disconcerting to us because really what it is the insurance company is getting cheap reinsurance from the state, and if they bet wrong and the state has to pay out, the taxpayers have to pay. So the insurance companies are getting cheap reinsurance, and then when the CAT fund runs out of money, rather, you know, the insurance company is off the hook and taxpayers have to be assessed to pay to finance the bonds, and that's really all I have to say.
Well, the taxpayer isn't assessed in Florida, so that's inaccurate.
Policyholder.
The infrastructure point is a good point. You know what? Actually, take a look at our plan in more detail. I think it would be perfectly suitable if the RAA thinks that commercial ought to be added to the legislation so that the CAT fund can extend more protection at lower cost to commercial policyholders. We would be certainly open to that. Moreover, when it comes to infrastructure, this is very important, and that's why this has to be integrated It has to be, this is not, it can't just be, you can't look at one piece of this in isolation. That's why I'm emphasizing again that, you know, I put it in those five categories. You can put them in different categories, but the infrastructure point is a good one. And this would absolutely help deal with infrastructure. Let's talk about levees, okay? Levees were a big problem, reason for so much of the loss in New Orleans, right? Well, part of the prevention mitigation that we're talking about, again, you can take a small segment of the investment income from the state and national catastrophe fund model, and you can make sure that you're doing a better job with the prevention and mitigation programs that are out there. Levees are a good example. You need to look at bridges. You need to look at levees. You need to look at those things because they are absolutely a big part of this. So it's not just about homeowners insurance. It's not just about insurance, as I said. So the infrastructure is a good point, and that has to be part of what that commission would do, is make sure that we're overseeing, working with the experts in the public and the private sector, again, at the local, state, and national level, working closely with the emergency management professionals, working with engineers, working with the governors. They're on the front lines on the states, and working with people that at the national level are responsible for helping prepare and protect. So absolutely, the infrastructure is a big part of this.
I think we got a question from Mike Walters.
This whole issue is about capacity, obviously, and I guess the theory of capital markets reinsurance was the traditional reinsurance market worldwide had 50 or 60 billion in surplus. Wall Street had 6 trillion. Maybe there's a way to capitalize this and so forth. There have been experiments. The CEA actually acquired some capital market reinsurance placement. Did either or both of the panelists comment on the ability, theoretically and practically, for capital markets reinsurance to enter into a possible solution?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting you say that because it's something that I know Congress and the administration is always fascinated by, because the capital markets do have trillions of dollars to tap into. And I know in the terrorism aspect, as it relates to capital markets, they're actually aggressively trying to talk to capital markets players to see why they're not entering that. On the natural disaster side, I definitely think that there is opportunity there. I guess the question is, and I know that I think it was a GAO, Government Accountability Office, based on a request by Chairman Oxley, asked the GAO to basically go out and interview issuers and investors and reinsurers and direct companies about the ability and the desire of the capital markets to provide natural disaster risk. And they have provided some capacity, but to many's dismay, they just don't have the appetite to provide more. I think it might be because traditional reinsurance has a little bit better underwriting knowledge, as well as maybe can provide it cheaper. But we would welcome more capacity, particularly in Florida, by the capital markets. They just haven't. Now, I'm certainly not the expert at the REA. I'm sure someone at my office would give a much better answer than this. But they're there. They've provided some, but not enough capacity where it's going to be the solution. And I think, you know, it's too bad.
Yeah, it would be welcome additional capacity, but it just has not developed. And people have been playing with different security arrangements, the cat bonds, that whole area, and it just really hasn't developed. I think there's something like 1 or 2% of the entire capacity that's supported by the cat bond idea. I think that it's important to keep looking and come up with new ideas, but so far it hasn't panned out. And so what we know is that the catastrophe model, like Florida, like California, it's tried and tested and it works. So we think that's a good place, and we shouldn't wait just because there might be other ideas out there to generate even more capacity. We shouldn't just wait for those other ideas to pan out. We should get to work now and at least deal with what we know works.
Over here.
Buying earthquake insurance about 19%.
when you say it's successful and it'll be affordable, and this person, and I think the other 80% are saying it's too expensive, unaffordable, all the way for the government, I don't see how it jives.
Yeah, no, the model, the financial backstop model is successful, and it allowed the California homeowners market to come back. Certainly isn't perfect. And here's a couple of the places where it's really deficient. And we did some research in California and got those same kind of stories. And I was talking to some emergency management people at the earthquake conference back in April. And you have experts, right, that know the kind of damage. And, you know, some of them don't buy the coverage. Part of the reason they're not buying coverage is that the deductible is so high. That's what they say anyway. And what the national backstop will do is be able to complement the CEA in a way that deductible might be able to come down, and it certainly will help facilitate a lowering in the cost of the earthquake coverage. So a lot of people are saying that it's just on the margin for them too expensive. But that consumer education point that I had up there as part of the solution, it's incredibly important. That's that personal responsibility point that I made, is that we need to better educate people. And here's what some of the people told us, is that, well, you know, why buy the coverage? Because the government's going to come. You know, they believe, and we just reinforce with Katrina, in the helicopter or the Air Force One plan. They think that they're going to be okay. Well, we've got to change the paradigm. And, you know, it's going to be up to public policymakers to decide whether or not mandatory coverage makes sense, but it's at least incongruous today to have a situation where for flood, Fannie and Freddie basically require the lending community to mandate flood insurance in the 1 in 100 year zone. And it's not very well enforced. You know, they trade the mortgages and they don't carry through with the requirement, and you know, the maps are out of date, and the 1 in 100 year maybe isn't even the right thing to do. But let's just put that on the side and say, okay, why does it make sense to have mandatory coverage for flood but not for earthquake? See, that just doesn't make sense. So what we need to do is we need the lending community at this table too. And we need others at this table, too, because we've got to figure that out. We got to break through. It is unacceptable that only 14% of the people in the state of California are buying earthquake coverage. That's unacceptable. The problem is not the CEA. The problem is that people are making that choice not to buy the coverage, and we got to get at that. So, good point.
Yeah, and I just wanted to, you know, have an observation, and it is disconcerting to those that don't support state cat funds that prior, as I said in my point earlier, prior to the CEA being created, when direct companies were writing, there was 37% participation, people buying earthquake insurance. And then the direct companies basically got out of the business and passed it on to the states, and there's only 17% insurance availability. And so that's what I think will catch the eyes of lawmakers if they do decide to go down this route, that if we're going to have a homeowners insurance availability act, we've got to look at programs that are in place, and do they actually provide for homeowners insurance availability? And clearly, California is not a success story when you think about, was more insurance available because of the state program? The answer is simply no.
Another question?
There was discussion regarding availability and affordability of capacity in the reinsurance marketplace this year. I'd like you to discuss, what do you think the impact of two extremely large homeowners carriers going into the reinsurance marketplace for the very first time, and do you think that in fact it's a short-term capital issue in the reinsurance, or is it longer?
It's similar to what happened after Andrew, where I think there was $5 billion of new capital that came in, and I think $12 billion after September 11th. I think clearly it's a market opportunity for companies assuming that they assume the prices are going to come back up. So I think that the dynamics occurred before, and hopefully these reinsurance startups will be there, and they'll continue to provide capacity. But I think the dynamic of new capital coming in clearly relates to the influx of the market and the losses that occurred that year.
Yeah, it's just, from my point of view, way too tenuous for the consumer. And that's just an unacceptable situation. That's the status quo, and that's why we're calling for comprehensive integrated reform. Yes, sir.
I have another question for Ed. You showed the homeowners' results of the last 15 or so years. Where is the money going to come from to fund this pre-funded mechanism, and how large of a fund do you need to have, do you think, and are any details like that worked out? Because I don't see it being cheaper or anything else. So I'm a little confused.
Well, it comes from the person who has the exposure. So for the person, for the homeowner, the person living on the beach is going to pay for the cost, and actuaries are going to project costs, expenses, to make sure that it's an actuarially sound rate. In doing that analysis, though, what you won't be doing is you won't be factoring in the tax aspect or the profit load that goes into that portion. So it's, the analogy is, just go right to Florida. It will work the way it's working in Florida, where the CAT fund, State of Florida CAT fund, extends the reinsurance cover to those companies that want to purchase it. It's optional to buy it from the CAT fund. Everyone does, and everyone does at the 90 percentile. So at the state level, you would do it just like that. Now the triggers, we're open to discussion on triggers, but in Florida, it starts at $5.5 billion. So if an aggregate loss for the industry is $5.5 billion, then the benefits of the state CAT fund flow to the consumer, okay? Basically, here's part of the national component, because I'm going to go at the answer a little differently. What something that a lot of people that are students of the real world when it comes to regulatory experience recognize that there's a lot of rate suppression that goes on at the state level. What the national backstop, the Consumer Help Fund, the Consumer Hurricane and Earthquake Loss Protection Fund, in House Bill 4366, what it would do is require the state to certify that the rates are actuarially sound. Okay, so the state wouldn't be able to manipulate for political reasons. If it wants to get the benefit of the national backstop, the Consumer Help Fund, it would have to, and the Secretary of the Treasury, or that kind of detail can be modified in the legislation too, but that's how the sponsor structured it, can enforce that. So you've got a whole new world, and you've got the senator from the good state of Illinois or Iowa, or pick the state, is going to make darn sure that the Secretary of Treasury is making sure that those states that are exposed to hurricane are adequately pricing that coverage, because they don't want the Air Force One plan to continue to cost their taxpayers a lot of money. So it would be more rigorous than it is today. It's still all based on actuarial science. The money comes from the person who has the exposure. It's just going to go into a CAT fund instead of flow offshore to private reinsurers, that portion of it. That's the difference. Does that make sense?
You answered my question,
Okay.
How large a fund and how quickly can you fund it?
Well, you can start. Just again, I'll give you the tried and tested example, is you can do it like in Florida. I mean, they can start up pretty quickly. It doesn't require a large bureaucracy. It's a very small staff.
How soon do you get them adequate level of capital in this fund?
How soon would it be fully funded?
Yeah.
Well, that's the other feature of this that gives you a real advantage. The national backstop, the federal government, like no one else in the universe, or at least in our part of the universe, can deal with the timing risk like the federal government does. A private company goes flat on its back, it's bankrupt. federal government doesn't go bankrupt. So if there's insufficient cash collected before there's an event, the federal government has the ability to help deal with that timing risk. Dr. Robert Lighton wrote a very good paper. He's with the Brookings Institute, and he spends a little time and he points out that very point on the timing risk, and he does a pretty good job with that. I would encourage you to go to the Brookings website, and you can read more about that in a little more detail.
Well, just a comment. That's why we're so concerned when you have a federal program that's basically providing reinsurance at working levels, because they don't have that timing risk. So you can imagine how cheaply it would be priced. We cannot. Private reinsurers, private market can't afford that timing risk, so we do have to charge a price for it. And in the federal program, there's no risk load, and when we tried to debate this 8 years ago, we had to work as hard as we could just to get language in there that said the federal reinsurance had to mirror private sector rates. And quite frankly, we weren't comfortable with that, but the new bill that's out there, that language is stripped. So there's no requirement that the federal government has to take in a timing risk. And I think that's pretty pathetic that they don't, because it's going to be the taxpayers that are going to be paying for it.
Well, it depends on the consumer, but on average in Florida, rates need to go up.
Do you believe the federal government will support a rate increase for homeowners? Given the way state regulations tend to suppress
it. Well, let me answer it this way. Leaders in the state of Florida recognize that rates are inadequate. In fact, the state legislature just recently adopted some comprehensive reforms for the state market to raise rates. So yes, it's taken a long time, but that reality is setting in. Now what we're suggesting is a means to get to adequacy easier. Some places are already rate adequate. But look, you've got states in this country that don't even accept modeling as a basis for rate making. So there are a lot of issues. It's very complicated, but it gets down to this very simply. Florida, yes, rates need to go up for most people that have the most exposure. And even the politicians in the state of Florida are recognizing that. So this is a way to get to rate adequacy in a way that's best for the consumer, that's going to provide maximum protection, and is going to facilitate these other components of the solution that are so critical.
Can we add another one here? Someone?
She kind of touched on the question that I had. You can shake your head regarding if there was a shortfall due to the timing risk, that they would just assess it, or it would come back to the taxpayer. And isn't that, that's really the fundamental federal backstop is, exactly what's happening for Hurricane Katrina. It does work very well and it provides protection. There's this huge $1 billion assessment coming through last year and this year.
No, that's Citizens. You're mixing up Citizens with the CAT fund. That's what's wrong with the state of Florida. What's right about the state of Florida is the CAT fund, not Citizens. Citizens is the assessment that you're referring to last year, and then another one and another one. There may be a very small assessment because of the CAT fund in Florida this year that will go on all policyholders to support the bonds. There's nothing on taxpayers. At the national level, let's spend a minute on the national level. At the national level, in response to that last comment, no, the taxpayers will be completely protected from any assessments or charges. That help fund will be completely funded by policyholders and the companies from whom they get their insurance. Taxpayers will be completely insulated from that. The federal government will every year determine what is the next year's charge, what is the, you know, and if that changes, and the bonding costs, so if there's the, that timing risk comes into play.
so that there's more money flowing than is in the current account, the HELP fund, that will go into the charge that the policyholder, the homeowner, will pay that's getting the benefit of the national the HELP fund. So what will happen is policyholders, not taxpayers, will be paying for that. The point about the timing risk, and again, go take a look at Dr. Lighten's paper, the point is there is that the federal government can borrow the money. But those borrowing costs go not to the taxpayer, they go to the policyholder.
I would just...
Well, no, in practice, that's the way that it works in the legislation. And, you know, you can, look, we can overstate the difficulties too, but we've got some harsh facts that we've got to deal with. And so that's why we think it's time to take what has worked. Lots of things are not perfect. Florida, the whole market is not perfect, but the CAP fund is a very good component of that market today, and build upon it. Use our experience to know what works, build upon it, improve upon it, build in the protections that you might and others might think are going to be needed, but let's get at it.
In the back.
Is there anything inside the national CAP program to control exposure costs as they grow over time? Like in Florida, the average size of a home has increased rapidly.
Yeah, I'm not sure I completely understand your question. Should we prohibit people from building bigger houses?
Is that part of it?
Yeah, yeah. I think that, and I mentioned that we need to definitely do a better job with building codes, land use policies. You know, there's a lot of, fortunately, still undeveloped space on the coast, but boy, not too much anymore, certainly not in Florida. But you know, we need a backbone in our country to start saying you can't build in some places, or if you've built and it's destroyed, that you can't rebuild. How you build that big house though is so important. You can have a big house, you can build a really big house hurricane proof. It costs a lot more money, but that's what we have to do. I mean, I'm not so sure about telling people they can't build certain size homes. But I do know we can tell them you've got to build it in a certain way.
Well, I was just saying, limited to those certain size homes. If they're above that certain size, they don't get the benefits of the protection. That's the size
of yes, home. Yes.
You,
that.
You take 1,000 square foot homes that are on the coast right now.
Yes.
And they're being torn down to build 3,000 square foot homes.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks that are in the state legislature that agree with you down in Florida, and they're... at least making some of the very expensive homes ineligible for citizens. That's kind of the way they're going at it, so that they're going to have difficulty. They're going to be self-insuring to some extent. But no, it's a fair point. And, you know, this isn't, don't make the mistake, though, that some people do, that this is just about affluent people living on the beach. There are a lot of areas in our country. And I've spent time with a senator from Texas who represents a district near Houston. And, you know, there are people that are far from affluent that are living in the most exposed areas there. They're out working on the oil rigs. And they're living close to the water because they have to. That's where their job is. So, yeah, there's a lot of affluent people and some opulent large homes on the beach. But it's not just about the rich and famous.
We're here.
All the money that's collected for the CAP fund, does it all go into a federal fund, or are there individual funds by state or some combination?
Combination. The state CAP fund, again, the proposal we offer would not replace the Florida CAP fund. I'll just use that as the example, so that the Florida CAP fund would continue to collect and hold money as it does today. What it would do is then get a backstop from the Consumer Help Fund at the national level.
and it would be basically buying coverage for itself then from the national fund, the help fund, and would be remitting some premium up to it. So the Florida fund would continue to hold money, and it would remit up to the national CAT fund monies too.
Over here.
Feel compelled to comment as actuary for Florida Office of Insurance Regulation. Certainly Florida is unique. The number of miles of coastline per resident is not matched anywhere else in the country. We're also unique in that our building codes are better for new buildings than any other state, including Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and the neighboring coast. I've heard it said at least three or four times by independent people there that rate suppression is an obvious given in Florida. I rarely try to speak on behalf of the commissioner, but I'll make an exception. The commissioner is committed to no rate suppression, particularly in current homeowners. In general, he is committed to no rate suppression. What we are committed to, though, is documentation and rate filings, and so the response may not be instantaneous, but we're aware, well aware, of when the start of hurricane season is, to be sure that adequate rates, if applied for, are in place in time if the company's willing to document the request. One question for you, Mary. You mentioned, again, the refrain that Florida is unique. With respect to terrorism, one might say that some of the big target risks and target cities in the United States are unique. However, it seems that there's a broad consensus that if TREA in some form had not been extended, there would have been a complete collapse of reinsurance. As you said yourself, there's no market, there's no private market. Why is it that there's no market for terrorism, but hurricanes are fine, and so are earthquakes, completely private hands on the system?
Well, for terrorism, well, first of all, when I say Florida is unique, I'm actually acknowledging that there potentially is a reinsurance capacity issue there. And as it relates to terrorism, I think that's the whole point about there's a bunch of unique properties, and that's why reinsurers, you know, there's Florida's unique, Texas is unique, Houston's unique, Cleveland's unique, Akron's unique, across the board. So there's only so much capacity or willing to lose that reinsurance company is able to do as it relates to terrorism, because there's so many potential threats that as a sound underwriter you have to consider. And so there's just really limited capacity, or their company is just only one put so much willing to lose. A natural disaster, is that they have a much better handle on it, and their willing to lose number is larger, and so therefore there's more capacity. But having said that, Florida is unique because it sticks out there like a sore thumb, so the willing to lose number as it relates to a natural disaster isn't as high as it might be in Texas or New York or North Carolina.
And just I need to comment, Howard. You know, I've had the privilege of being in discussions on panels and at events with Commissioner McCarty. And Florida's, maybe it's not quite unique, but Commissioner McCarty has demonstrated exceptional leadership on the issue. He has led the way. He was a co-host at a historic summit in San Francisco with Commissioner Garamendi, Superintendent Mills, Director McRaith from the land of Lincoln and Reagan. He's concerned about catastrophe, but Commissioner McCarty has led the way. He's done it at the NAIC level. He's done it working with some congressmen and women from the state of Florida, rallying support for the national backstop. I had the privilege of handling Florida and spending time in Tallahassee when we were able to get the statewide building code adopted. Statewide, kind of a misnomer because they ended up exempting the panhandle, and we know what Ivan and Dennis did over there, but just remarkable, a great building code, and you know, it's absolutely stunning. You don't need to be very sophisticated. You can go take a look at a home built with the under the new code, and right down the block, the old code, new code, hardly any damage. Old code, virtually gone. I mean, it's really remarkable. Florida's taken some good action, and Commissioner McCarty has been one of the great champions in the country. So what we're hoping is that others, you all are experts. You guys bring an insurance and broader perspective to it. I encourage you to go to the website to sign up, talk to your colleagues, talk to your friends and family. What we have to do, and we have to because we're part of this industry, people still think of this as a significant insurance issue. We need to help lead the way. And, you know, maybe we can reach some more common ground on concepts, and we can work together to work out the details. You know, there's good examples and models out there. We need to build on them. And we need to work together to achieve the objective. And that objective is to better prepare and better protect consumers. And so I really appreciate the time to be here and talk to you about it. And I encourage you to go to the website, sign up, learn more. And I'll hang around if anyone wants to talk a little bit more to me, too.
That sounded like a closing. Do you want to have another one, Howard?
No, I just wanted to say that certainly the commissioner's position is well known, and his leadership is there is well known. Some people have said this is just Florida looking for a subsidy from the rest of the country, but actually what we're looking for is to be able to support ourselves, and we're looking for support from the other states to be able to properly manage the catastrophe risk that we pose. And it seems that that's what federalism should be about, rather than making sure that Florida is unique and is isolated to completely retain its entire risk and finance it.
Well said.
Anybody else? Okay, why don't we give our speakers a round of applause?